Hello and welcome to Dyslexia Explored. I'm Darius Nomdaron, your host. Today I have a mother who wants to share a little bit about an interesting passion project of hers. She has written a children's storybook about real life dyslexic people who are what she calls brilliantly dyslexic. And she'll tell the story about how she was surprised there wasn't a children's storybook about people who have dyslexia. And so she went and did it as her own passion project. In the daytime, she's a business and product strategy in that realm. And she's a mum of a brilliantly dyslexic husband, and not mum of a husband, but a mum of a brilliant dyslexic daughter. And as a husband who's also dyslexic, lives in San Francisco. And we're going to have an interesting talk around the area of socio and emotional aspects of dyslexia. And she's got some insights that she's got from writing this book about the socio and emotional aspects of dyslexia and what we can do about it as parents. So I'd love to introduce you to Liz Trudeau. It's great to have you here, Liz.
Thank you. I'm thrilled to be here.
So we ask everyone a set of questions in the podcast, like, you know, what's your dyslexia story? And then, you know, leading towards you, this passion project of yours with the book. So what was life like before you were aware of dyslexia, and what woke you up to dyslexia?
That's a great question. I think my dyslexia story is really my family's dyslexia story. I really didn't have much of an understanding of dyslexia. If you probably asked me about it 15 years ago, I would have said something like the reversal of letters or writing backwards, like most people would say. And that all changed about 10 years ago when my husband watched a documentary on dyslexia and called me in and said, "You have to watch this. I'm dyslexic." And it was like the answer to a question he had never asked. He had struggled academically, but obviously had many talents, strengths, and intelligence, but never could understand why foreign languages were just a disaster and why his grades didn't reflect his actual knowledge. And so that puzzle piece was opened up for him that has been incredibly helpful. And then at the same time, about the same, I think, year, actually, our daughter was born. And it became very clear early on that her brain worked very differently than her older brother, than my brain as well. And she struggled with everything related to language. And when it became time to get her assessed, it was very clear that she herself was dyslexic. And we were really grateful that my husband had identified that in himself, because it made it clear to us that we had to be looking for something. And it was also just such a gift, because it did not feel as scary, or I suppose knowing, we'll have to reverse that, it felt, knowing that he's dyslexic and that this is something they shared, it wasn't as scary as if we were just finding this out without knowing that her father was also dyslexic as well.
Fantastic. What was the documentary? Can you remember?
You know, I've looked for it. I think it might have been The Big Picture. I'm not 100% sure, actually.
Okay. Well, it's fascinating to see how all this content going out about dyslexia, you know, really does wake people up. And, you know, that wake up call's important. It's interesting, because that's the first time someone's properly woken up to their dyslexia that I've heard in this podcast, because of a documentary and not just a particular person coming to them and saying, "I think you're dyslexic," or, you know, it being an actual person, you know, waking them up to it. Fascinating. So what would you say in your journey has been your main challenge, the big challenge that you've faced?
I think the big challenge is having a child who has so many giftings, who's so much to offer to the world, very creative, highly intelligent, to have that child in an education system that really works very differently than her brain. Yeah. And so the challenge really has been on the confidence and the socio-emotional aspects. Certainly the struggles remain on the academic side. That is something that we certainly have not conquered. But the hardest parts, I think, are keeping up the confidence in the midst of working on some of the things that are the hardest for her. I would say, you know, even with the support from her parents and being in a school context where her teachers have always been very supportive of her, it's just the structure of the curriculum was never really aligned to where her giftings would be. So even in that context, she really struggled to feel like she was good enough, to feel like she was smart. And it really took a toll on her. She had high anxiety. She was constantly calling herself stupid or dumb, which is never anything she was hearing from her teachers or from the outside world. It was something she had decided for herself based on what she was experiencing in the classroom or in seeing what other kids could do and what she was struggling with. And so I would say that has been, continues to be some of the biggest aspects is building confidence and keeping that up.
So this socio-emotional learning is actually becoming quite a big thing in America, I think. The reason I say it is maybe it's because of my connection to Peggy Stern. I don't know if you know Peggy, I mentioned her before. She's created this video series for schools about dyslexia, which are all focused around the socio-emotional aspects of dyslexia. So they take different topics and they've got a group of kids that do it. And do you know what? I feel terrible because I don't know. Yeah, Super D-ville it's called. I don't know if you've heard of it, but it's just been launched and it's a way to help schools deal with the socio-emotional aspect of dyslexia and SPLD in schools. So it's really fascinating to hear you starting to say that term because I don't hear it very much actually as a term. So when tell the listeners a little bit about socio-emotional, how do you define that? What do you mean by that?
It's a dangerous question to ask a layman who that question. I am not an expert in this actual field, but the way that I would define it really from my experience and parenting is really, you know, taking the social and the emotional. And so the emotional being, how do you feel about yourself? What's going on with you? And then the social being, how do you engage with others and see yourself relative to that environment? So it's really interacting with yourself and interacting with others and what that looks like. That's how I think of it.
I love that explanation. And, you know, I think it's easy to think, it's obvious to see with your own child the impact that it has on their emotions, but it's not always obvious to realize that it impacts their social aspect of things. And isn't that fascinating that the moment you start putting yourself down inwardly, it starts to affect your relationships with other people, doesn't it? I mean, can you share some of your thoughts and observations of that? Maybe not necessarily about your own child, but in general?
Yeah, certainly. I think personally, again, I'm not a researcher or expert on this, but just even speaking from my own experience, how we think about ourselves reflects in the way that we engage with others. Either we're searching for confirming or disconfirming information and the way that we interact, or we're projecting things. We're afraid of certain interactions and so we avoid them. I don't think this is unique to my daughter's experience, but if we struggle with something, we avoid it. And so you're putting up a lot of energy into these interactions that other people aren't putting in because you're avoiding the things that would cause trouble because they're highly socially aware, socially engaged, highly empathetic. And so crafting situations that are going to avoid you having to read or write or sort of things to venture into areas where you struggle. I mean, that's just one example of, I think, one of the tolls that it can take. But I think there's many others that play out in the way that we project what we feel about ourselves into the friendships and the relationships that we have.
Yeah. We did an interview with Stan Gloss where we talked about Brené Brown's work on shame and, you know, how that can start creeping in and so on as well. And once shame starts creeping in, you don't realize the effects it can have. So if you're interested in that whole area, there's another episode, a few episodes on shame earlier on, I think in the 90s. Somewhere in the 90th episode or something like that. I'll look for it. We'll put it in the show notes.
Oh yeah, I would love to. I'm a huge Brené Brown fan. And I think that's a really relevant thing to bring up of, I think the struggle and the nuance between I'm struggling with this versus I am bad and I am a failure.
Yes.
That is a very big difference,
yes.
But it's so easy to make that assessment in your brain.
I remember I wrote this little poem, not a poem, but I was with a young child that I know, and he said, I can't do that. And when it came to reading or whatever, and all I wanted to give him was one word, which was yet.
Yeah.
You know, I can't yet, you know, I couldn't. I can't tie my shoelaces. There was a point where I felt, I can't tie my shoelaces. I can't tell the time. I can't read this. I can't write this. I can't write this story. All sorts of can'ts I couldn't do. But at the time it was actually, I can't yet. And that yet keeps the door open for the answer. But when you shut the door on yet and you just stick with can't, then that door is shut and it doesn't matter what's out there. You've just got a shut door. And I think it's so important that people keep that door open of yet.
100%. And I think it's really critical what you just said. And what's so easy to miss as parents and as teachers is that asking the child, saying I can't, is feels much safer than saying yet. The word, yeah. Including the word yet, actually requires a lot of vulnerability on behalf of the child and requires a much safer space,
yeah,
for the child. And so, because what you're asking for them to do is hope, and hoping,
yes,
is just such a vulnerable, fragile thing to,
yes,
do.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. That's very good. Yes. I totally agree. And I mean, I find that with Bullet Map Academy, you know, one of the things, you know, when children come to us and the parents like, oh, I really want my child to do this. And sometimes the child's like, I'm not sure I want to learn how to do this mind mapping thing because, and you can see they're like, I don't want to get my hopes up and I don't want to fail at another thing. You know, and it's even worse when it's something that's good for dyslexia or whatever, and then you fail at that, you know, and there's this, and actually it's the, you don't want to waste a child's hope, as it were, you know, and I think that's so important, you know?
Yes. Oh gosh. Wasting a child's hope. That's such a beautiful way of saying it. I couldn't agree more.
And you can see it in children. I mean, I see it with teenagers, you know, that they're deflecting, evading, ducking, diving. It's all self-protection, you know, and we self-protect in all sorts of different ways. Anyway, so let's look at, so we looked at what life like was before dyslexia, the wake-up call, what the challenge has been with the socio and emotional, and the reward. What kind of, you've got this passion project where you started this book because of your daughter, and it's quite interesting. So tell us a little bit about what it's led to.
Yeah, so I started this book really as a desire to help build her confidence. I had noticed that even though her father's dyslexic, even though she's had a lot of positivity around dyslexia, her experience was quite different. She was not particularly excited about being dyslexic. And the one thing that seemed to make a difference was talking about other people in the world who do all sorts of different things, who are dyslexic. We looked up a bunch of people on the internet. And I realized that these stories mattered to her. She really perked up. And so I looked for a book. I thought there must be a children's book out there that tells the stories of all these amazing people in the world who were dyslexic, and I couldn't find it. And so I started writing stories myself and putting them in a binder for her. And so we have a binder. I should have brought it in here with me. So we have a binder of stories of people with dyslexia. And then I got to thinking, well, if we needed this book, these stories, then maybe other people do too. And so I shared it with some parents and some kids and some teachers. And the response was very clear that yes, we do need this book. Dyslexia doesn't show up a ton in children's book. There's some fiction stories. There's some amazing things out there today, but that we don't tell the stories of the real people in the world in an in-depth way. We may reference them. There's some picture books, I think, out there, but we don't tell their stories of how they struggled, what they felt like as a child, how they found their strengths, what ended up working for them. And so that's what these stories are about. And so then I set on this journey that's really been about 2 years of me working from about 5 a.m. to 7 a.m. on stories, writing the stories, editing them, finding the illustrators, and really producing this into a book.
Fantastic. And so can we wind back a little bit to, could you tell us a little story about how your daughter reacted to a particular story of another dyslexic? Could you just give us a little vignette of, you know, let me be more specific. Was there a wake-up call moment for you when a particular story was told and you saw a reaction from your daughter and you thought, ah, I'm onto something here?
Yes. So I knew the stories mattered, that hearing about other people who were doing incredible things would help build her confidence in that it would give her a future vision of all these options. We all need to be able to imagine a future ahead of us. And it would help her imagine that. What I didn't realize is how much it would provoke her to be able to sort of identify and express some of the feelings she was feeling in the moment. So that's one aspect of it, that there were a few stories, one about a dancer this is in the original binder. There was one about a dancer that when she was younger, she would hide in the school closet to avoid doing reading and writing. And her teacher would find her nestled amongst the school supplies. And my daughter's response to that aspect of the story was, I want to hide sometimes too. And so it created the space to talk about some of the things that she was feeling and to normalize what she was feeling as completely fine. This is a normal reaction to some of the things that she's experiencing. So that was one of the responses. There's an abstract artist in the book. She loves art. She loves abstract art. And so this artist has become a real role model for her. And so that's the story she really connected to.
Who are they?
Heather Day is the abstract artist. Her work is amazing. But then the other aspect, so that was surprising to me. The other part that was surprising to me is really the impact that researching these stories had on me as a parent. Mm. And it was really, as we talked earlier, I mentioned that if I quit this project today after putting in this all this work, I still would have thought this was a worthwhile effort, really, for what I learned as a parent. And that's because when I looked across these stories, there were these themes that were very clear, almost like they gave me a blueprint of what's important. And spoiler, it wasn't the academic or a particular type of tutoring or, you know, check this box and do this thing, which is, as a parent supporting a child who learns differently, you have to do a lot of those things. You have to seek out the right tutoring. You have to advocate for them at school. You have to encourage them to keep going and get them. They have to learn to work hard. It's just sort of part of the journey. But there was this whole other aspect that I realized looking across these stories that was as important, if not, I would actually say more important than the academic side. And that's the socio-emotional piece that we were talking about, that the two biggest things for across the stories, the most important things, the things that people referenced and the things that seemed like they had to be there for somebody to thrive, were an adult who believed in them and saw them for who they are, meaning saw their strengths, saw all the things that make them amazing. That was absolutely critical. And the second thing is an opportunity to play to your strengths, to find your strengths, to find something that you feel successful in all throughout your journey. And it may not be, again, as a parent, it's like tempting. And I see a lot of the language, in, at least in the parenting community, of finding someone's superpower or finding the thing that they thrive in. It's really easy to want, it's, I think, tempting to want to try to peg a child as like, oh, this is your thing and you're going to do this forever. And so I say sort of that as a caveat, that that wasn't really it. It was just always finding something. Maybe it's a thing they'll stick with. Maybe it's not. Like there's a venture capitalist in the book, David Hornick.
We interviewed David in the podcast as well. Yes.
Oh, so you know all about David. He's amazing.
He's a great guy, isn't he?
Well, if somebody hasn't heard that podcast, they should go back and listen to it because he is so enjoyable.
It was really quite emotional, actually, the podcast with David, you know.
I'm going to go look it up.
Really touching.
Well, part of David's story was, you know, as a child and as a young person, he really leaned on his performance abilities. So in a variety of contexts, whether it's in the classroom context of trying to convert assignments into different assignments of, hey, maybe I'll do a play or maybe I'll sing a song for this instead. But and then really on stage, he was a performer, an actor, really accomplished violinist. And he imagined he would be a concert violinist as an adult. And so he had all this data that would probably say that that was where he was headed. But he changed paths and he ended up choosing a different path and winding his way through. And
he became a lawyer.
He became a lawyer.
Yeah. And then we actually did a mind map video about David Hornick. So it's a time-lapse mind map of the podcast episode 84. Check it out, listeners. And there's a little video. We'll put a video in there that summarizes it as a quick explainer video with pictures and so on of him at Harvard and Stanford and being a lecturer that spells badly and things like that. It's hilarious.
Oh, he's phenomenal. And you know, he said one of the things that's really stuck with me as well, too, of when I asked him why did you agree to tell your story and to be in this book? He said, you know, the world tells us as kids that smart kids read and readers are smart. What about all the smart kids who don't read? And that really stuck with me because I think that is the case. And that was certainly the case for my daughter, regardless of what we would say. The world was telling her that readers are smart, smart kids read. And so she was left thinking, well, I must not be smart. Mm. I think that was really critical.
Yes, fantastic. This podcast is sponsored by dyslexiaproductivitycoaching.com, which helps you organize yourself creatively with a productivity system for Apple devices. Right. So when does the book come out and when can we see it?
Yeah. So the stories are finished and we are doing pre-orders in about a month. And so folks can go to our website, brilliantlydyslexic.com, and get a sample set of stories. And then that'll also mean you'll get notified when we are ready to launch and do pre-orders.
Fantastic. So if you're listening, just tap on your screen, scroll up. There'll be some text there, description with some hyperlinks to what Liz has just said, the brilliantlydyslexic.org. Did you say com?
Brilliantlydyslexic.com.
Com. Brilliant. Fantastic. I look forward to seeing that and reading that. So let's drill down a little bit more. Okay. And we've got some more questions that I tend to ask, which is, often, how do you learn? You know, one of the things that fascinates me is, you know, you just said often it says leaders are readers, Have you ever heard that phrase?
I never have, but I'm not surprised.
Okay, so in leadership circles, if you're a business person, businessman, woman, you keep hearing over and over, if you're going to be a leader, you have to be a reader. But actually what the really meaning is, leaders are learners.
Yes.
And so, you know, a lot of people, you can learn a ton of stuff from books, and the reality is we really need to be listening to a lot more books. And, you know, reading books with your ears, as it were, listening to them is important because there's so much distilled knowledge. And by the way, are you going to do an audio version of your book, by the way?
Yes, that is the plan. It's going to come out after the physical version, but yes, an audio version.
So kids can listen to it and look through the pictures as well. Brilliant. Mm-hmm. So back to the point, how do you learn? Is what I often ask people, you know, what way do you learn now that you found your way of thinking, your way of learning, etc.? And obviously this isn't your dyslexia story, but what about your observations of how your child or how your husband or how these people you've interviewed or these stories, what have you discovered about how they learn?
That's a great question. It's diverse. And I think that's one of the things that's important for folks to remember is that dyslexia looks different on a lot of different people. There's some commonalities, but there's also a lot of diversity in there. And so what works for one person isn't what works for another. So I think that's really important that we hold open the space for nuance. That said, you know, some people, and, you know, just an example, some people really struggled with memorization. I actually think David Hornick was one of those people where memorization was just not his thing. Conceptual thought was his thing. And so in college, he would find the courses that really played to those strengths and avoid the other ones. So some people really struggle on the memorization part. And then on the other hand, other people really did well with it. Joe Witt Jr., and he's an NFL football coach, that's what got him through school, was his memorization and memory abilities, that he could memorize and then sort of perform. And he would use that as a way to cover for, if he had to read something out loud, he would memorize it, including an entire speech. And so he had really good memory abilities. But the ways I see that of learning that do seem common is sort of the visual aspect of it. So thinking visually, expressing visually, conceptual thought of being able to abstract, take something that's very broad and see all the connections between things. I actually work with somebody who I actually work with a few people in my day job who are dyslexic, and their ability to find the connections between disparate topics and draw those patterns is phenomenal. Yeah, so I think it's a tricky question that I think it's different for everybody, but I do think there's strong visual things, strong conceptual connection pieces. So having the big picture, I think, is really important for folks. And then I also think the learning by doing was a very strong thread through people's stories. Is having to do it for themselves and learning, I guess, so the learning by doing.
And in your daughter's example, she's kind of learnt through story.
Yes, really good point. Very strong. I think that's a common thing for people with dyslexia, is that really strong story memory, connection to story, ability to tell stories. And I think in my daughter, it's a way of organizing thoughts.
Yes.
Is by crafting, taking this very broad conceptual sense of, like, I think my perspective on it is, I think she sees the world practically in technicolor and in more dimensions than perhaps I do. And that can perhaps feel very chaotic to her. Like, how do you distill that down? And I think she refers to, I think that's why the concreteness of a story, which organizes that for herself, is really helpful. And then I think it's also why she tends to orient towards just trying things out, making things, doing things her own way, because that also is very concrete, because it's connecting to actual action.
Yeah. So mind mapping, as you know, I'm totally bonkers about mind mapping. I love mind mapping. I run a mind mapping company called Bullet Map Academy, where we teach children how to visually organize their thoughts. And one of the reasons why we ask this question is, what's been your relationship to mind mapping in this journey? And there's no, you know, right or wrong answer to this. Some people are totally, oh, my maps are amazing. I use them all the time. And other people never heard of it. What is that? And where have you come across it in your dyslexia journey?
Yeah, I would say really two aspects. One, sort of formally in my actual professional context, we use mind mapping for both generating ideas as well as then organizing them into sort of clustering them. So that's professionally, I see that being very helpful. And then as a parent, I was realizing I was inadvertently doing a little bit of it, certainly not at a master level, just in the way we, as I was working with my daughter in organizing her writing, of visually brainstorming or sort of more visually extracting her thoughts onto paper and then being able to organize those post-it notes and into stories that she could tell. So we've sort of, I think, dipped our toe into the water, but of mind mapping, but haven't really dived in quite yet, though.
Looking at the, how many people, going back to your book, how many people did you actually interview for it then?
So the stories are a mix of interviews and then research.
How many stories are there? I've seen some, the beautiful pictures, really lovely illustrations of, you know, Richard Branson and other famous people that we've heard of and the other people. I'm looking forward to hearing the list. So is it 20 stories in there, did you say?
Yeah, it's 20 and change.
Okay, around 20. And what is it, half and half interviewed and half research, would you say? Okay.
It's about that. It's about half and half. And most of them have been, and some of them have been edited by, maybe I wrote it by desk research and then the person's gone through and edited. It was really important to me in the way each story was told that it reflected how they would tell their story, that it wasn't me placing a narrative on it. And so there's some stories that actually never mention the word dyslexia because it's not a word that they use when they tell their story.
Really? And can you give us an example? Like who?
That is a great question. Like who? Byron Pitts. He's a journalist for ABC News at the moment. He used to work at 60 Minutes here in the States. He never uses the word dyslexia.
Okay.
However, he could not read really until his teenage years. At all. He had a really, really, he has a quite dramatic story, really amazing story of the sort of the impact of having a supportive parent during the process. So he never actually uses the word dyslexia. And so his story doesn't use that word as well.
So that's fascinating. So did you research him and then write it and then send it to him and ask if what his take was and how he would like it done?
So the way I would do it with the stories is, well, so some of them, if they were based on primary interview, I would research, interview, write. If it was based on research, then it would be research, share, and just, I would more ask if, you know, if it's inaccurate or if there's any changes. But it was more, if you do enough research and you listen to someone closely enough, you can start to, you can really get a sense of how would they tell their story.
Fantastic.
And that's what I was going for.
That is fantastic. So you're kind of ghostwriting their own story in a couple of pages, as it were.
That is the goal.
Yeah, I like it. That's nice. That's brilliant. If you could go back in time, let's say you could go back in time, send yourself as a parent a greetings card, what would it say on the front and what would the message be on the inside to yourself? So at what point would you send it to and what would you say to yourself?
It's a great question. I would send it, I think I would probably send it to myself in the very beginning and just say sort of open now and read repeatedly. I think it's something I would have to constantly remind myself. And I think it would say some combination, the front of it would say some combination of congratulations, you've got this. And the congratulations bit being like, you have an amazing journey ahead of you. Not my particular journey, but you have an amazing child with an amazing brain and who is going to teach you a ton. So congratulations, this is going to be exciting, partially terrifying half the time, but really an adventure. And the you got this is really, really you've got this. It's going to be okay. Not knowing what to do is part of the journey. And on the inside, I think I would really just tell myself a few things is one, don't, this isn't, I think what the first thing, because I'm not dyslexic myself, I think the first thing I would say is, this is not your story. This is, so get super curious about her story and discover it together. That it's not up to me to figure out how this plays out. That's up to her, and it's going to be an amazing adventure. The second thing would be to, as we talked about earlier, focus as much on the socio-emotional as the academic. And then the last thing would be to, in while of course getting the academic support and the support with the reading, we do all need to learn to read and write. But don't make sure, find those ways to separate the reading and the writing from the learning as quickly as possible so that the reading and the writing doesn't get in the way of the learning and the expressing. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so. So what you're saying is, so they can still be learning while they're learning to read and write. There's learning coming from other sources until their learning can come from reading and writing. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, if it ever does.
If it ever does, okay.
If it ever does. I know my husband still prefers to listen to audiobooks.
Yes.
And things like that. And so I say that because our education system is really set up to very, very quickly move from learning to read and write to learning through reading and writing.
Yes.
And so we have to make a conscious effort as parents to separate those two and really find those ways for learning to happen without the regulator of basically like it's much learning. You have this thing that's going to, if you're struggling with reading and writing, it's going to hold back the other learning, and we need to find ways to really get around that.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. That's fascinating because I'm still learning that, and I'm tutoring kids with dyslexia. Well, not myself directly. Well, a little bit, but my team is. And an example of that would be, for example, let's say you're studying biology and you've got a textbook in front of you and the child's taking notes from the textbook. What they're often doing is just copying what's in the textbook because they've not got the skills to distinguish what's the important keywords and to distill it down. One of the things that I've been doing with my students is like, okay, let's go to the textbook, but not just yet. Let's watch a YouTube video on this topic. We'll watch a YouTube video and just doodle some thoughts as you're going through it in a circle and doodle through that video. And then we'll watch it again. It's maybe 7 minutes long. Watch it again, add some keywords and so on. And then we'll go and look at it in our third experience of this material in the detail of the words so that you can start extracting it. And what's happened is they've started with their strength, which is visualizing it, picturing it, getting a feel of what the conceptual level is without the pressure of I've got to understand every single word. And they've got a frame of reference that they start filling in, and then they can fill it in with the little details. It's like doing a jigsaw. You get the edges in place. You've got that right. Okay, this is roughly that color. That's roughly this. And then you can start putting in the little details. Whereas often in school, it's like doing a jigsaw puzzle from one corner of the jigsaw puzzle, and you just fill everything in the right order until you've filled the whole thing in. Yeah. It's just not the way we think, you know?
100%. I mean, what you're reminding me of is, well, yes, because you didn't, my understanding is from from everything I've learned is the dyslexic brain doesn't sort of build up like granule by granule. It's seeing the broader picture and then coming down into to the details. And it was, you know, that was one of the things, one of the stories that jumps out to me from that is Beryl Benassaroff, who is a doctor and Harvard professor. She talked about how much she struggled with how painful it was to be such a fast thinker who could see the entire problem, the beginning and the end, but to be a slow reader. And she referred to it as, you brought up puzzles. She referred to it, I think she referred to it this way. She referred to it as, it's like putting together a puzzle with the pieces scattered across the room. You could never pull them. You can think quickly, but you could never get them corralled fast enough to really get the full picture when you were trying to read as a way of getting to the information.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. When I explain it to children, I say to it, it's like I've got a zero gravity brain. And the way I describe it is, imagine you've got a workshop and you build things in your workshop, okay? And you go and you start making something on the table and you build it and you go away for a break and you come back and on your table, your workshop table, it's all gone. And you're like, what happened? I thought I was working on something. And you go, it's all gone. And then someone taps you on the shoulder and says, look up. And you look up and there it is, all floating, bouncing off the ceiling. And you're like, oh, there's that thought. You pull it all back together again. You put it on the table. And then someone interrupts you, or mum says it's dinner time or whatever. And off you go and you come back. And guess what? It's floating on the ceiling again. And you have to constantly remember, really put together everything over and over again. Except my wife's brain, she puts it on the table, she walks away. 3 weeks later, she comes back to that table, everything's sitting in the right order that she left it in. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, I 100% do. And I think it's just such a beautiful visual analogy to think about it that way. And I love it because it helps everybody realize how different our brains work. That I'm sure from your wife's perspective, she would assume if she hadn't heard your story, she would assume that everyone's brains work that way. Yes. And so then when people do things based on the way that their brain works, it seems foreign and it doesn't make sense. And so I think the more we can all understand the diversity of how each of us thinks, the more we can connect with each other, because I think I have also heard a lot from the adult dyslexic perspective. And because it's not like, oh, once you learn to read and write, then everything's taken care of.
Yeah, no.
It's a real different way of engaging with the world and with information. It's just a different way of processing. And so the answer for dyslexia is not just learning to read and write and getting the reading instruction better. That is definitely something we need to be doing, but it's also creating more education and a world where people's different way of thinking, that neurodiversity is something that people understand, so that throughout your life, you feel like you are not just, you're not other, because that's the feeling that I'm hearing a lot from adults, is the sense of feeling different and struggling with confidence because of that.
A lovely story that happened to me this week was about using your strengths to your advantage with dyslexia. Like, I think in that 10 to 14 year old realm, children have to start getting really good at figuring out how they can use their strength to their advantage in school, as well as outside of school. So David Hornick actually shared some really powerful insights into this in terms of team playing and how to work with the teachers and negotiate and discuss things and figure out what they want, and the diplomacy and negotiation that he's kind of carried on into venture capitalism. I'll leave that to that talk. But what happened here today, this last few weeks, was I was speaking to a child and they were learning about cigarettes in biology and the effects they have on the human body. And she had done this map mind map of it. And she'd mapped it all out. And I get children to do something called a flash map, where they turn the map over and they have to quickly draw it and see what they can remember from their map within 2 minutes. And then they flip it back over and they say, I got that, got that, got that. And then you find the gaps where you didn't get it. And if you didn't get it, it's a weakness in your map, not in your mind. And so you go, why is it that you can't remember the effects of smoking so much? Because it's just a word with some other words. And I said, so what would help you remember effects of smoking? What image? And she said, I don't know. And then she said, what do you think? And I said, I don't know either. what would be a good picture for effects? So we went into Google Images, typed it in, effects, and we saw lots of images about effects. None of them helped. And we said, effects of smoking, type that in. We saw all these decaying lungs and sallow faces and so on. And we're like, all right, we could draw that in. But then she fixated on a picture of trees. So there was trees on the top that were living and alive and trees on the bottom that had been burnt down. And that was effects. And she said, I'm going to use that. And I said, why are you using that for cigarettes and lungs? And she said, well, I think lungs are a bit like trees, where they kind of absorb stuff and so on. And then the cigarettes are a bit like damaging the trees and then they stop growing and so on. And I'm like, wow, yes, that is effects. And so what she had just done, she had used her visual strength of connecting different ideas and translating it into some sort of meaning that made sense to her, to actually not just remember that smoking affects your lungs and does X, Y, and Z, but to actually understand the nature of lungs and so on. Isn't that amazing?
That's phenomenal. Yes, that is really amazing. And I think what you're saying is so critical, that learning to figuring out your strengths and how you learn and how you also can express and engage with others about what you learn. I think that is a critical skill, that especially when the sort of the world and the education system isn't designed around the way that you think, you sort of have to find that for yourself.
Yes. And if you're listening to this as parents, or as adults or educators, I just share you a little tip while we're on the topic that just struck me this week, was that ties in with what you're saying. If you can find what the child's really interested in, what they're fascinated by, number one, then within what they're fascinated by, what they're really automatic at, intuitive at, and good at. So that's the next smaller circle. Okay. And actually, if you go one step further, if you can find within that realm of fascination and thing that they're good at, some people who have got some pain in that realm, they will be able to find a solution to that. And if you can find that in your life, it's an area you're fascinated by, that you're automatically good at, and there's a pain point that you can solve, then you've got a lifetime of excellence, meaning, and income.
That's a really good point. I think you just defined my husband's career.
Really?
Yeah.
What does your husband do?
He runs a nonprofit for the homeless and marginally housed here in San Francisco. And it's a community center, a living room for those who have no living room. And what he is naturally interested in, one of the things, is people. What he's naturally amazing at is connecting at people from all sorts of backgrounds, which I think his dyslexia really plays into it. Like, he can have, where many people struggle to converse with people who have an incredibly different life story than he does, he can connect and get to the root of the human experience so quickly. And then he can translate that for other people. And so he's able to engage with people who are experiencing homelessness and people who have a lot of resources who want to volunteer. And then if you go, so obviously then those people skills also then translate into, well, is there a problem? Well, yes, there's a problem. We have a problem with homelessness. And so yeah, that I feel like your funnel is a really perfect depiction of his career.
And what I was, that was before I was going to go with a specific thing with teaching and tutoring, is that I learned this yesterday quite strongly, is that, or this last week, if you can find what your child is really interested in and not just segment it for outside of school, but let's say they're learning about, let's just go back to biology. They're learning about biology and they're really into dance. Then you could ask the question, right, we're learning about lungs and the cigarettes and so on. Is there something to do with dance that could maybe connect with this? And if they're dyslexic, they will find some connection, you know? And they, what happens is you start leveraging the thing they're intensely interested in and fascinating and bring it in to enliven what they're learning. But what it takes is to ask the right question, which is, how could this abstract thought of photosynthesis, what could it be like related to dancing? Now, if they're a dancer, they might say, well, it's kind of like the sun is dancing, and then the plant is moving in relation to the sun, and there's like a rhythm, and there's a what do you call it when you work out a dance, you know, like a
Choreography.
choreography. So there's a particular choreography for that plant and so on. And they start visualizing it in a language that they're natural at, which is dance.
Think that's brilliant.
And so there's this huge, immense possibility as parents and as educators. If we identify what they're really good at and make sure they do what they're naturally good at, but we leverage it and get a double benefit by saying, could you tap into that knowledge you've got already and it enrich what you're learning about geography or whatever you're doing? And then they start getting excited.
100%. And I think even taking it a step further of not even just using that as a way to learn the material, but finding those teachers who are open to being flexible to the way that the student expresses and demonstrates their knowledge, I think is really important. There's one, John Hoke, who's the chief creative officer of Nike. He talks about he's very skilled artist. And one of the ways he thrived in school is that his teachers were flexible enough that they accepted his projects and his reports, which were like 90% visual and drawing with some scrawled words that he mirror writes as well. So he's like half the time they were upside down and backwards, the words that were on there, but they accepted that work as a demonstration of knowledge versus requiring him to put his knowledge into a different form, which would have been sort of a demonstration of it's a demonstration of knowledge within this particular structure, which is
Yes.
not which is too confining.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Fantastic. I've had a lovely conversation. Thank you very much, Liz, for sharing. There is one final question I ask most people, which is, what tools for organization or gadgets or apps are you kind of using or working on? What kind of tools do you sort of turn to as a daily staple to help you with dyslexia? Not
Oh,
your
well, it's
personal
helped.
dyslexia, but your child or parent, your husband.
Well, I think we're a post-it note family.
Yes.
So we have a lot of post-it notes. I would say none of us, we all have a lot of, I would say, we're more free thinking and have lots of ideas and aren't the most organized, myself included. And so we use a lot, there's a lot of post-it notes around the house, a lot of lists. We haven't quite found the system, I would say, that works for us all to stay organized.
I need to show you my bullet map planner with lots of sticky notes on it. I have these micro sticky notes, and each little sticky notes is a 25-minute task, and I can move them around and reorganize them like a Kanban board.
Oh my goodness. I would love to see that. That sounds like a dream.
Here's a stash of them. I'll show you. For those of you who are listening, I will visually, verbally describe it. So it's one sheet of paper where you write down all your random thoughts here on one panel, and then you draw a map, and then you take lots of little stickies and put them on the map and then reorganize them in a list. So you end up with a list of sticky notes that you can lift and move over to the other side when you've done them and reorganize them. And kids can put them up on their kitchen door, their fridge door with a magnet, or you can carry it around in your pocket as your own like little flip up to-do list.
I love that. That's incredible.
You might like that. I'll send you over a template for that. Anyway, Liz, it's been great meeting you. We'll share all the links, and actually when your book goes live, get in touch with us as well so we can do the updated link for the live book as well, so this podcast will be listened to for years to come. So Liz, it's been great having you on the show. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Great. See ya. This podcast is sponsored by dyslexiaproductivitycoaching.com. It's my day job when I'm not hosting this podcast. Tell me, do you know what you want to achieve in the workplace, but you're struggling with how to achieve it? Maybe you suspect some traits of dyslexia are getting in the way. Well, that's where Dyslexia Productivity Coaching comes in, because we give you a simple productivity system for your Apple devices that harnesses the creativity that comes with your dyslexia. It includes proven methods like note-taking, reminders, speech-to-text, mind mapping, and more, all tailored to your needs. It'll free up your time and help you achieve outstanding results. Book a complimentary call to discuss it with me, and if you do it soon, I may also be available to coach you personally via Zoom. So don't be shy, go to dyslexiaproductivitycoaching.com or swipe up and book it now.